Welcome to AM Best Audio.
What is the history of workers' compensation, and how has the system evolved over the years? I'm Lori Chortis for AM Best TV. Joining us now to talk about that is Chris Boggs, Executive Director, Risk Management and Education at the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of America. He is also the author of the book, The Insurance Professional's Practical Guide to Workers' Compensation, From History Through Audit. Chris, thanks for joining me today.
I appreciate you having me. I'm honored.
What inspired you to write the book and the recently released second edition of the book?
Well, actually, it was when I worked for my former employer, Insurance Journal, prior to going to work for Big Eye. And I had written, I was hired to write technical articles, coverage articles and all that fun stuff, because I'm a geek that actually likes insurance and likes talking about insurance and writing about insurance and speak. I'm sad. Let's just be honest about that. And part of the series, I wrote a series of articles on workers' compensation and all the various aspects of work comp. So when I got done with the series, I took it to the management and said, "Hey, would you like to turn this into a book?" And they said, "Yeah, I think we would." They had never, I mean, interestingly enough, they're a publishing company, but they've always published magazines and they never published a book. So they said, "Let's give it a try." So it came out of the series of work comp articles, because it's a very interesting and troublesome, to some extent, topic, even though the concept overall is pretty simple.
Can you talk a bit about the history of workers' compensation and what led to its creation?
It's actually kind of a fascinating history. There's some myths and legends around it that over time, in what I've heard back from individuals when I had written the series of articles, that I learned was sort of true. One of the myths or legends was that the pirates did, in fact, have a code that sort of intimates or acts like workers' comp, where if you were injured and you did not have the opportunity to participate in the plunder, if you will, you still got paid because you were a member of the crew. Now, I just thought that was mystery and legend, but over time, I have learned that it is, in fact, true. That was on. It was. I was watching the Travel Channel the other night, and they were talking about that again, about the fact that different pirates had different codes, and that code was you get paid because you're a member of the crew, even if you're injured. So that was sort of the fun start of it. But it actually began in Europe in the late 1800s. Germany specifically was the first country that offered a type of workers' comp employer's liability, employee injury type system, and it didn't actually make it to America until the early 1900s. The initial laws in America were actually struck down from 1902, I believe it was, up until about 1911, 1913, were actually struck down as unconstitutional, because it was a required coverage, and the states and the federal government said, you can't do that. You can't require insurance. So it really wasn't until 1917 that the laws passed that they could, in fact, require certain types of insurance. Workers' comp jumped on that and became became one of the first required compulsory coverages that you could purchase. But the interesting part of the history of it is the stories that I thought were just stories that I have learned over time were in fact true sort of came out of the coal mines of West Virginia. And prior to the institution of workers' comp, basically the only remedy that an injured employee had was to sue the employer and to prove that the employer was somehow negligent in causing their injury. Well, the stories that came out of the coal mine areas were that an employee would get injured during the day, the company would come and put him on the doorstep and knock on the door and walk away. And the family really had no way to recover from that. And I had just thought that was sort of myth, and people were using hyperbole in order to express the desire for a need for a system to manage work-related injury. But I have since learned from individuals that had that happen in their families that in fact is true, that they would just leave the injured employees on the desk, on the doorstep of their house and walk away. But one of the last major incidences that led to what I tend to believe might be the ability of workers' comp to take hold and be approved as a compulsory law was a New York, I think it was 1911, 1912, somewhere in there. I think it was 1911. That New York had, in fact, put in place a workers' comp code the New York Appeals Court, which my understanding is in New York, that's actually the highest court in New York State, the New York Appeals Court declared it unconstitutional. And the next day, dozens, I think over 100 people died in a fire at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And the only recourse the people had was to sue. And I think the number was $75 that the families got for these 100 and some people dying as a result of this work-related fire. Most of them didn't die in the fire. They died jumping out of 9th and 10th story building to get away from the fire. So that was sort of the impetus of the creation, was an ability where the employer, because prior to workers' comp, the employee had to go to court and prove the employer was negligent. Well, a lot of times they couldn't afford to do that. And sometimes getting hurt at work doesn't necessarily mean the employer was negligent anyway. So the workers' comp was designed as a way to, basically it's a sole remedy is what it's called and what it's referred to as sole remedy, that nobody's admitting negligence. You were injured arising out of in the course and scope of employment. Thus, we have this system that is an insurance type system to help you pay for some of your expenses and lost revenue and lost wages that come from the fact that you were injured while benefiting your employer. So that's a very quick history, if you will, of workers' comp in the U.S. as it relates. So I can't remember what year it was, 1918, I believe it was when Wisconsin finally had a law that stuck. So theirs is considered the first in the country. You have to check me on my dates on that. I'm going by memory and it isn't what it used to be.
So how has the system changed or evolved over the years into the system that we see today?
Essentially, it hasn't. I guess what's changed the most is the legal climate. It's become so very regulated. The initial founding or the initial creation of workers' comp is workers' comp as a concept is very simplistic. You have somebody who's working, you have somebody who gets hurt while they're working, and you pay for it. Very simplistic. And it was sort of really designed, again, coming out of the time that it was created, it was sort of designed for a one location, one operation. Somebody's working in a manufacturing operation, they're working on a farm, whatever. It was sort of designed for that. Well, over time, it has sort of expanded out because you have people traveling across state lines to do work and everything else. It's become a very it's legalistic. From a legal standpoint, it has evolved to keep up with what has changed in our work lives. So it was designed for more for a singular location type situation. So it's evolved because of the necessity of work and how people work, where people work, the fact that we're not tied to a manufacturing location, a mill someplace. We're moving all the time. So it's evolved because of our work system has evolved. And our workplaces and what we do for a living has evolved so radically over the last 102, 103 years that of necessity, courts have had to get involved. So that's how it has changed and why it's changed so much over time. And coupled with the fact that we're dealing with 51 different jurisdictions and 51 different ideas of how things should be done from a work comp perspective.
So what are some of the similarities, some of the differences in applicable workers' compensation statutes?
Well, that's actually a very easy question because there's only one similarity. Everything else is different. The one similarity is basically what workers' comp will pay for. It'll pay for medical expenses, it'll pay for lost wages, and it'll pay a death benefit. Beyond that, there is nothing similar. Again, we have 51 different jurisdictions who all have a different idea of how the work comp system should apply. We think it should be easy because it arises out of the course and scope of employment. Yeah, okay. But there's actually, depending on what state you're in, a different level of what's considered course and scope. Then it's if you have employees traveling across state lines, that's called extraterritoriality and reciprocity when they go to another state to work. Well, no two states do that alike either. So like I said, the easy part of that question is what's similar? One thing. Everything else is completely different across the country, which is why, as I said, the concept of workers' comp is very simple. The problem is that if you've got an insured, as coming from the agency side or the carrier side, if you've got people working across multiple state lines, you do have to know those 5, 6, 7, 8, however many states are involved, all those different laws as it relates to who counts as an employee. Does it matter if it's an entity type, goes from a corporation or it's an LLC? Or so like I said, it's a simplistic answer, but it's a very complicated reality in the fact that we got one similarity. Everything else is up in the air depending on what state you're in.
The book looks at various aspects of workers' comp law. What types of injuries are compensable and what constitutes an occupational disease?
Well, injury, basically, to be compensable under workers' comp, it has to arise out of and be in the course and scope of employment. And I don't want to get too deep into this because it's an hour-long class by itself, is what constitutes arising out of in the course and scope of employment, as I said, does actually vary by state. And it sounds like it should be simple. It's not simple. But when it arises out of in the course and scope of employment, is basically, were you injured while you were doing something for the benefit of your employer? That's the most basic way to put it. It's not exact, but it's about the most basic way you can put it. So, most of us, when COVID hit, we went to work from home. I was already working from home, so that was not a big change to me. But those who had never worked from home before, we started having the conversation, well, if they get injured, if they fall down their stairs while they're going to lunch, is that compensable? Well, I don't know. Who were they benefiting? Were they benefiting their employer? Or were they benefiting themselves? What was the situation? So, it's to be compensable. Sounds like it should be simplistic. Arising out of course and scope of employment, easiest way to look at it, were you benefiting your employer when you were injured? Now, occupational injury or occupational disease, the easiest way to think about that is that sort of has its basis in, let's go back to the coal mines. It has its basis in the idea of coal mines and black lung disease. Now, my grandfather worked in the mills and he had brown lung disease. To be an occupational disease and compensable under workers' comp, it has to be something that's peculiar to your work. So that if you think about black lung disease, really the only people who got black lung disease were those who were down there digging in the coal mines. Mill workers got brown lung disease. If you look today and you look at medical personnel who might get a bloodborne disease or something because it's peculiar to their work. So an occupational disease is slightly easier to define, because it's something that about your work that makes it peculiar, that you get a disease that's not common to man, if you will. And that's how you kind of judge that, which is actually easier than the arising out of in course and scope of employment occupational injury side of it.
Can you talk a bit about the importance of employers' liability coverage in managing the work comp audit?
Sure. Employers' liability is one of those coverages that gets ignored, for lack of a better way of putting it, because it's considered by a lot of agents and even some on the carrier side to be a throw-in coverage, because you see it as part two of the workers' comp policy. You have work comp and employer's liability. I would hazard to guess that a large percentage of agents have never seen an employer's liability claim. So because they've never seen it, they really don't pay attention to the importance of it, but it is actually a hugely important coverage. Employer's liability has commonality between the workers' comp policy and the commercial general liability policy. And it fills the gap between those two coverages, because work comp pays for injury to an employee arising out of course and scope of employment or an occupational disease. General liability pays for injury to somebody who is not an employee. Well, if an employee gets injured by something that's not work-related necessarily, but does in some way relate to the work, or if a family member is injured because of something to do with the employee, the GL policy specifically excludes it. The workers' comp policy doesn't cover it. So you got this gap between these two coverages, and that's where employer's liability lives. It fills that gap between the work comp and the GL policy. So it is an extremely important coverage, even though you'll rarely ever see a claim, but it does cover specific events, dual capacity situations where the old story they use to explain the dual capacity is, if you are a truck driver and you work for the company that manufactures the tires on the truck and you're blowing up the tire and it explodes, you have a products claim against the manufacturer who also happens to be your employer. Well, that's an employer's liability type claim. Then you have third party over. I don't want to bore you with that. Then you have, if somebody in your family gets sick because you bring home a work-related disease or somebody who works around nuclear material radiation type, and they bring home somebody to get sick because of it, that's an employer's liability loss. So it is a very important coverage that people often ignore, because very rarely do you see a claim. But when you do see a claim, it can be bad, because it comes out of what I used to call HIP National Bank, which means you got to pay for it yourself if you don't have coverage, and that's the reason you need the employer's liability coverage. Now, the audit, that's a whole different world. Workers' comp, largely 99.5% of the time, is based on payroll. And the audit is to make sure at the end of the policy period that the insurance carrier got the money for the exposure they took on. At the beginning of the policy period, you guess what the payroll is going to be. Well, you don't have any idea at the beginning what it really is going to be when you get to the end. And so you estimate whatever many thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars or whatever, and at the end of the policy period, the insurance carrier gets to come back and say, well, let's check and see what you got and see if you owe us money or we owe you money because you overestimated. For whatever reason, somewhere along the way, somebody got the idea that the audit should be pushed down within the insured's operation, within the business's operation, to the lowest person on the totem pole because it's going to take time. That's wrong. The better way to handle the audit is it needs to be treated like it's the IRS coming in to some extent, because they're coming in to find out if you owe them more money. So you need somebody there who can answer the questions, who can take them around and show them what they need to do, and also be trained and understand the business. I have a friend of mine who developed what he called the ABCs of premium audit. I stole them from him, but he gave me his blessing to do that, so I still use them. ABC is always be there. And his point was that the president, vice president, somebody who is high up needs to be available for the audit, to meet with the auditor, be prepared, have the books and records and everything you need in order for the auditor to do their job, because they're going to ask questions. And the easier you make it for them, ultimately the better results you're going to get out of it, because they have a job and they're just doing their job. It's nothing personal. And get a copy of the auditor's work papers. And here's the main reason for that. It is much easier to correct a mistake while they're there than 3 weeks from now after they left and they've processed the audit and you get this additional premium bill and you don't understand why. So that's the ABCs of premium audit. I added a few to it, like answer the questions that are asked, be honest, and don't offer more information than what is asked for. Because business owners tend to be very proud, might be the better term, about their business. And they'll talk about things they're not doing, but it requires the auditor then to ask more questions. So answer what's asked, be honest, be truthful, and be prepared.
So looking ahead, what do you foresee for the future of workers' comp in the coming years?
That's a really tough question. For years, I've been in the insurance business 31 years. And since I've gotten into the business, for nearly all of those 31 years, I keep hearing about 24-hour coverage, where there wouldn't be a medical system, there wouldn't be a workers' comp system, there would be a system. Whether or not that will ever happen, I don't know. Whether or not it can happen, I don't know. Workers' comp is priced and pays out and is based a lot on jurisdiction. So if I'm injured in one state, I'm going to get different compensation than I'm going to get in another state for whatever was for the, you know, the loss of a thumb or whatever. So whether or not that can be done on a 24-hour federal basis, I don't have any idea. There are some things that are, I don't want to say broken, but there are some things in workers' comp that can probably be better to, forgive the way I say this, basically get the lawyers to stop talking about it on TV and make the system what it was designed to be. Like, as I mentioned earlier, it's become more of a legal problem because the lawyers have gotten so involved, and there are times when, don't misunderstand, that lawyers are in fact necessary to get the system to act like it's supposed to act. But whether or not that's going to be fixed over the remainder of my career, I don't have any idea. So I don't see much changing unless it becomes a point where it's so broken that the feds do step in and create a national system that might have pluses and may have more minuses than pluses. I don't know. I haven't mapped that out, but that would be, to me, the only thing that I see that could possibly change. Other than that, I really don't know. That's a really tough one for me.
So what do you hope people will take away from your book?
You know, basically, as I mentioned, I wrote the book. The book came about as a series of articles. So I didn't set out in my life to write a book. I set out to write a series of articles to help people understand the intricacies and the weirdness of workers' comp. But in that, in looking at the book and looking at the contents of the book as somebody's reading it, I hope that not only do they see the intricacies and the uniqueness of workers' comp, but they see why geeks like me enjoy it. Because it is, as I said, it is so simplistic in its creation, but it is so detailed and nuanced in its application that people like me just absolutely love it. I taught a class years ago in a community college. I taught a semester. And I was teaching to a group of people who were getting a human resources degree. They could care less about insurance. Absolutely care less about insurance. But at the end of the semester, one of the students said, "We understand why you love it." We don't, but we understand why you do. So that's sort of what I hope is not only do you get the information and you're able to apply the information and understanding how each state plays by its own rules, but that you see why it's unique and why in a different way, why Olive Insurance is sort of unique and why it's fascinating and why, forgive the way I say this, that insurance is in fact sexy in a sad sort of way.
Chris, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Again, I'm honored.
We've been speaking with Chris Boggs, Executive Director, Risk Management and Education at the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of America. He's also the author of Insurance Professionals' Practical Guide to Workers' Compensation from History Through Audit. For AM Best TV, I'm Lori Chortis.
Looking to get the full attention of the insurance industry? We have the platforms that will do just that. Whether it be AM Best TV, AM Best Audio, Best Review Magazine, or Best Day. Find out more by calling AM Best Advertising Sales at 908-439-2200, extension 5399, and have a great day.